Chapter 12. Diggory kept his mouth very tight shut. He had been growing more and more uncomfortable. He hoped that whatever happened, he wouldn't blub or do anything ridiculous. "Son of Adam," said Aslan, "are you ready to undo the wrong that you have done to my sweet country of Narnia on the very day of its birth?"
"Well, I don't see what I can do," said Diggory. "You see, the queen ran away, and
I asked, are you ready?" said the lion.
"Yes," said Diggory.
He had had for a second some wild idea of saying, "I'll try to help you, if you promise to help my mother." But he realized just in time that the lion was not at all the sort of person one could try to make bargains with. But when he had said, "Yes," the thought of his mother, and he thought of the great hopes he had had, and how they were all dying away, and a lump came in his throat and tears in his eyes, and he blurted out, "But please, please, won't you, can't you give me something that will cure my mother?" Up until that moment, he had been looking at the lion's great feet and the huge claws on them. Now, in his despair, he looked up at its face. What he saw surprised him as much as anything in his whole life, for the tawny face was bent down near his own, and, wonder of wonders, great shining tears stood in the lion's eyes. They were such big, bright tears compared to Diggory's own that for a moment he felt as if the lion must really be sorrier about his mother than he was himself.
My son," said Aslan, "I know. Grief is great. Only you and I in this land know that yet. Let us be good to one another. But I have to think of hundreds of years in the life of Narnia. The witch whom you have brought into this world will come back to Narnia again, but it need not be yet. It is my wish to plant a tree in Narnia that she will not dare to approach, and that tree will protect Narnia from her for many years. So this land shall have a long, bright morning before any clouds come over the sun. You must get me the seed from which that tree is to grow."
"Yes, sir," said Diggory. He didn't know how it was to be done, but he felt quite sure now that he would be able to do it. The lion drew a deep breath, stooped its head over even lower, and gave him a lion's kiss. And at once, Diggory felt that new strength and courage had gone over into him.
"Dear son," said Aslan, "I will tell you what you must do. Turn and look to the west. Tell me, what do you see?"
"I see terribly big mountains, Aslan," said Diggory. "I see this river coming down cliffs in a waterfall. Beyond that cliff, there are high green hills with forests. And beyond those are higher ranges that look almost black. And far away there are big snowy mountains, all heaped up together like pictures of the Alps. And beyond those there's nothing but the sky."
"You see well," said the lion.
"Now the land of Narnia ends where the waterfall comes down. Once you have reached the top of the cliffs, you will be out of Narnia and into the western wild. You must journey through those mountains till you find a green valley with a blue lake in it, walled round by mountains of ice. At the end of the lake, there is a steep green hill. At the top of that hill, there is a garden. In the center of that garden is a tree. Pluck an apple from that tree and bring it back to me."
"Yes, sir," said Diggory again.
He hadn't the least of idea of how he was going to climb the cliff and find his way among all of those mountains, but he didn't like to say it was for fear that it wouldn't sound like making excuses. But he did say, "I hope, Aslan, you're not in a hurry. I shan't be able to get there and back very quickly."
"Little son of Adam, you shall have help," said Aslan.
He then turned to the horse, who had been standing quietly beside them all this time, swishing his tail to keep the flies off, and listening with his head to one side, as if the conversation were a little difficult for it to understand.
"My dear," said Aslan to the horse, "would you like to be a winged horse?"
You should have seen how the horse shook its mane and how its nostrils widened, and the little tap it gave the ground with one back hoof.
Clearly, it would very much like to be a winged horse. But it only said, "If you wish, Aslan, if you really mean, I don't know why it should be me, I'm not a very clever horse." "Be winged. Be the father of all flying horses," roared Aslan in a voice that shook the ground. "Your name is Fledge." The horse shied, just as it might have shied in the old, miserable days when it pulled a hansom. Then it roared. It strained its neck back, as if it were to fly, or a fly biting its shoulders, and it wanted to scratch the shoulders. And then, just as the beast had burst out of the earth, there burst out from the shoulders of Fledge wings that spread and grew larger than eagles, larger than swans, larger than angels' wings in church windows. The feathers shone chestnut color and copper color. He gave them a great sweep and with them and leaped into the air. 20 feet above Aslan and Diggory, he snorted, neighed, and curvetted. Then, after circling once around them, he dropped to the earth, all fours, hoofs together, looking awkward and surprised, but extremely pleased. "Is it good, Fledge?" Aslan asked. "Oh, it's very good, Aslan," said Fledge. "Will you carry this little son of Adam on your back to the mountain valley I spoke of?" "What? Now? At once?" Strawberry asked. "Or Fledge, as we must now call him." "Hurrah! Come on, little one, I've had things like you on my back before, long, long ago, when there was green fields and sugar." "What are the two daughters of Eve whispering about?" Aslan asked, turning very suddenly to Polly and the cabby's wife, who had in fact been making friends. "If you please, sir," said Queen Helen, for that is what Nelly, the cabman's wife, now was, "I think the little girl would love to go too, if it weren't no trouble." "What does Fledge say about that?" asked the wine. "Oh, I don't mind too, not when they're little ones," said Fledge, "but I hope the elephant doesn't want to come as well." The elephant had no such wish, and the new King of Narnia helped both of the children up. That is, he gave Diggory a rough heave and set Polly as gently and daintily on the horse's back as if she were made of china and might break. "There they are, Strawberry, Fledge, I should say. This is a rum go." "Do not fly too high," said Aslan. "Do not try to go over the tops of the great ice mountains. Look out for the valleys, the green places, and fly through them. There will always be a way through. And now, be gone with my blessing." "Oh, Fledge," said Diggory, leaning forward to pat the horse's glossy neck. "This is fun. Hold on to me tight, Polly." Next moment, the country dropped away beneath them and whirled round as Fledge, like a huge pigeon, circled once or twice before setting off on his long westward flight. Looking down, Polly could hardly see the king and the queen, and even Aslan himself was only a bright yellow spot on the green grass. Soon the wind was in their faces and Fledge's wings settled down to a steady beat. All Narnia, many-colored with lawns and rocks and heather and different sorts of trees, lay spread out below them, the river winding through it like a ribbon of quicksilver. They could already see over the tops of the low hills, which lay northward on their right. Beyond those hills, a great moorland sloped gently up and up to the horizon. On their left, the mountains were much higher, but every now and then there was a gap when you could see between steep pine woods a glimpse of the southern lands that lay beyond them, looking blue and far away. "That'll be where Archland is," said Polly. "Yeah, but look ahead," said Diggory, for now a great barrier of cliffs rose before them, and they were almost dazzled by the sunlight dancing off the great waterfall by which the rivers roared and sparkles down into Narnia itself from the high western land into which it rises. They were flying so high already that the thunder of those falls could only be heard as a small, thin sound, but they were not yet high enough to fly over the top of the cliffs. "We'll have to do a bit of zigzagging here," said Fledge. "Hold on tight." He began flying to and fro, getting higher at each turn. The air grew colder, and they heard the call of eagles far below them. "I say, look back, said Polly.
There they could see the whole valley of Narnia stretched out to where, just before the eastern horizon, there was a gleam of sea. And now they were so high they could see tiny-looking jagged mountains appearing beyond the northwest moors, and plains of what looked like sand far to the south. "I wish we had someone to tell us what all these places are," Digger said. "I don't suppose they're anywhere yet," said Polly. "I mean, there's no one there, and nothing happening. The world's only just begun today." "No, but people will get there," said Diggory. "And then they'll have histories, you know." "Well, it's a jolly good thing they haven't now," said Polly, "because nobody can be made to learn it. Battles and dates and all that rot." Now they were over the top of the cliffs, and in a few minutes, the valley land of Narnia had sunk out of sight behind them. They were flying over a wild country of steep hills and dark forests, still following the course of the river. The really big mountains loomed ahead, but the sun was now in the travelers' eyes, and they couldn't see things very clearly in that direction. For the sun sank lower and lower, till the western sky was all like one great furnace full of melted gold, and it set at last behind a jagged peak which stood up against the brightness as sharp and flat as if it were cut out of cardboard. "It's none too warm up here," said Polly. "And my wings are beginning to ache," said Fledge. "There's no sign of the valley with a lake in it, like what Aslan said. What about coming down and looking out for a decent spot to spend the night in? We shan't reach that place tonight, anyway." "Yes, and surely it's about time for supper," Diggory said. So Fledge came lower and lower. As they came down nearer to the earth and among the hills, the air grew warmer, and after traveling so many hours with nothing to listen to but the beat of Fledge's wings, it was nice to hear the homely and earthly noises again, the chatter of the river on its stony bed and the creaking of the trees in the light wind. A warm, good smell of sun-baked earth and grass and flowers came up to them. At last, Fledge alighted. Diggory rolled off and helped Polly to dismount. Both were glad to stretch their stiff legs. The valley in which they had come down in was in the heart of the mountains. The snowy heights, one of them looking rose-red in the reflection of the sunset, towered before them. "I am hungry," said Diggory. "Well, tuck in," said Fledge, taking a big mouthful of grass. Then he raised his head, still chewing, with bits of grass sticking out on each side of his mouth like whiskers, and said, "Come on, you two, don't be shy. There's plenty for all of us." "But we can't eat grass," Diggory said. "Hmm," said Fledge, speaking with his mouthful. "Well, don't know quite what you'll do then. It's very good grass, too." Polly and Diggory stared at one another in dismay. "Well, I do think someone might have arranged about our meal," said Diggory. "I'm sure Aslan would have, if you'd asked him," said Fledge. "Wouldn't he know without being asked?" Polly said. "I've no doubt he would," said the horse, still talking with his mouth full. "But I've the sort of idea he likes to be asked." "But what on earth are we to do?" asked Diggory. "I'm sure I don't know," said Fledge. "Unless you try the grass, you might like it better than you think." "Oh, don't be silly," said Polly, stamping her foot. "Of course humans can't eat grass any more than you can eat a mutton chop." "For goodness sake, don't talk about chops and things," said Diggory. "It only makes it worse." Diggory said that Polly had better take herself home by ring and get something to eat there. He couldn't himself because he had promised to go straight on his message for Aslan. And if once he showed up again at home, anything might happen to prevent him getting back. But Polly said she wouldn't leave him, and Diggory said it was jolly decent of her. "I say," said Polly, "I've still got the remains of that bag of toffee in my jacket. It'll be better than nothing." "A lot better," said Diggory, "but be careful to get your hand into your pocket without touching a ring." That was a difficult and delicate job, but they managed it in the end. The little paper bag was very squashy and sticky when they finally got it out, so that it was more a question of tearing the bag off the toffees than getting the toffees out of the bag. Some grown-ups, you know how fussy they'd be about this sort of thing, would rather have gone without supper altogether than have eaten those toffees. There were 9 of them, all told. It was Diggory who had the bright idea of eating 4 each and planting the 9th, for, he said, if the bar off the lamppost turned into a little light tree, why shouldn't this turn into a toffee tree? So they dibbled a small hole of the earth and buried the piece of toffee. Then they ate the other pieces, making them last as long as they could. It was a poor meal, even with all the paper they couldn't help eating as well. When Fledge had quite finished his own excellent supper, he lay down. The children came and sat on one side of him, leaning against his warm body. And then he had spread his wings over each. When he had spread his wings over each, they were really quite snug. As the bright young stars of that new world came out, they talked over everything. How Diggory had hoped to get something for his mother, and how instead of that, he had been sent on this message. And they repeated to one another all the signs by which they would know the places they were looking. They were looking for the blue lake and the hill with a garden on top of it. The talk was just beginning to slow down when they got sleepy, when suddenly Polly sat up wide awake and said, "Hush!" Everyone listened as hard as they could. "Perhaps it was only the wind in the trees," said Diggory presently. "I'm not so sure," said Fledge. "Anyway, wait, there it goes again. By Aslan, it is something." The horse scrambled to its feet with a great noise and a great upheaval. The children were already on theirs. Fledge trotted to and fro, sniffing and whinnying. The children tiptoed this way and that, looking behind every bush and tree. They kept on thinking they saw things, and there was one time when Polly was perfectly certain she had seen a tall, dark figure gliding quickly away in the westerly direction. But they caught nothing, and in the end, Fledge lay down again, and the children re-snuggled, if that's the right word, under his wings. They went to sleep at once. Fledge stayed awake much longer, moving his ears to and fro in the darkness, and sometimes giving a little shiver with his skin as if a fly had lighted on him. But in the end, he too slept. Chapter 13. "Wake up, Diggory, wake up, Fledge," came the voice of Polly. "It has turned into a toffee tree, and it's the loveliest morning." The low, early sunshine was streaming through the wood, and the grass was gray with dew, and the cobwebs were like silver. Just beside them was a little, very dark wooded tree, about the size of an apple tree. The leaves were whitish and rather papery, like the herb called honesty, and it was loaded with little brown fruits that looked rather like dates. "Hurry," said Diggory, "but I'm going to have to take a dip first." He rushed through a flowering thicket or two down to the river's edge. Have you ever bathed in a mountain river that is running in shallow cataracts over red and blue and yellow stones with the sun on it? It is as good as the sea. In some ways, almost better. Of course, he had to dress again without drying, but it was well worth it. When he came back, Polly went down and had her bath. At least she said that was what she'd been doing, but we know she was not much of a swimmer, and perhaps it is best not to ask too many questions. Fledge visited the river too, but he only stood in midstream, stooping down for a long drink of water and then shaking his mane and neighing several times. Polly and Diggory got the work on the toffee tree. The fruit was delicious. Not exactly like toffee. It was softer, for one thing, and juicy, but it was like fruit, which reminded one of toffee. Fledge also made an excellent breakfast. He tried one of the coffee fruits and liked it, but said he felt more like grass at that hour in the morning. Then, with some difficulty, the children got on his back, and the second journey began. It was even better than yesterday, partly because everyone was feeling so fresh, and partly because the newly risen sun was on their backs, and of course, everything looked nicer and light when the light's behind you. It was a wonderful ride. The big snowy mountain rose above them in every direction. The valleys far beneath them were so green, and all the streams which tumbled down from the glaciers into the main river were so blue, that it was like flying over gigantic pieces of jewelry. They would have liked this part of the adventure to go on longer than it did, but quite soon they were all sniffing the air and saying, "What is it? And did you smell something? And where is it coming from?" For a heavenly smell, warm and golden, as if from all the most delicious fruits and flowers of the world, was coming up to them from somewhere up ahead. "It's coming from that valley with the lake in it," said Fledge. "So it is," said Diggory. "And look, there's a green hill at the far end of the lake. And look how blue that water is." "It must be the place," all three said simultaneously. The ledge came lower and lower in wide circles. The ice peaks rose up higher and higher above them. The air came up warmer and sweeter every moment, so sweet that it almost brought the tears to your eyes. Fledge was now gliding with his great wings spread out motionless on each side, and his hoofs pawing for the ground. The steep green hill was rushing towards them. A moment later, he alighted on its slope, a little awkwardly. The children rolled off, fell without hurting themselves on the warm, fine grass, and stood up panting a little. They were about 3/4 of the way up the hill, and set out at once to climb to the top. I don't think Fledge could have managed this without his wings to balance him and to give him the help of a flutter now and then. All around the very top of the hill ran a high wall of green turf. Inside the wall, trees were growing. Their branches hung out over the wall. Their leaves showed not only green, but also blue and silver when the wind stirred it. When the travelers reached the top, they walked nearly all the way around it outside the green walls, before they found the gates. High gates of gold, fast shut, facing due east. Up till now, I think Fledge and Polly had had the idea that they would go in with Diggory. But they thought so no longer. You never saw a place with so obviously private. You could see at a glance that it belonged to someone else. Only a fool would dream of going in unless he had been sent there on a very special business. Diggory himself understood at once that the others wouldn't and couldn't come in with him. He went forward to the gates alone. When he had come close up to them, he saw words written on the gold with silver letters, something to this effect: "Come in by the gold gates or not at all. Take of my fruit for others or forbear. For those who steal, or those who climb my walls, shall find their heart's desire and despair." "Take of my fruit for others," said Diggory to himself. "Well, that's what I'm going to do. It means I mustn't eat any myself, I suppose. I don't know what all that jaw in the last line is about. Come in by the gold gates. Well, who'd want to climb a wall if he could get in by a gate? But how do the gates open?" He laid his hand on them, and instantly they swung apart, opening inward, turning on their hinges without the least noise. Now that he could see into the place, it looked more private than ever. He went in very solemnly, looking about him. Everything was very quiet inside. Even the fountain, which rose near the middle of the garden, made only the faintest sound. The lovely smell was all around him. It was a happy place, but very serious. He knew which was the right tree at once, partly because it stood at the very center, and partly because the great silver apples on which it was loaded shone so and cast a light of their own down on the shadowy places where the sunlight did not reach. He walked straight to it, picked an apple, and put it in the breast pocket of his Norfolk jacket. But he couldn't help looking at it and smelling it before he put it away. It would have been better if he had not. A terrible thirst and hunger came over him, and a longing to taste that fruit. He put it hastily into his pocket. But there were plenty of others. Could it be wrong to taste one? After all, he thought, the notice at the gate might not have been exactly an order. It might have been only a piece of advice. And who cares about advice? Or even if it were an order. Would he be disobeying it by eating an apple? He had already obeyed the part about taking one for others. While he was thinking of all this, he happened to look up through the branches towards the top of the tree. There, on a branch above his head, a wonderful bird was roosting. I say roosting because it seemed almost asleep, but perhaps not quite. The tiniest slit of one eye was open. It was larger than an eagle, its breast saffron, its head crested with scarlet, and its tail purple. And it just shows, said Diggory afterwards, when he was telling the story to others, that you can't be too careful in these magical places. You never know what may be watching you. But I think Diggory would not have taken an apple for himself in any case. Things like do not steal were, I think, hammered into the boy's head a good deal harder in those days than they are now. Still, you can never be certain. Diggory was just turning to go back to the gates when he stopped to have one last look around. He got a terrible shock. He was not alone. There, only a few yards from him, stood the witch. She was just throwing away the core of an apple which she had eaten. The juice was darker than you would expect and made a horrid stain around her mouth. Diggory guessed at once that she must have climbed in over the wall, and he began to see that there might be some sense in that last line about getting your heart's desire and getting despair along with it, for the witch looked stronger and prouder than ever, and even, in a way, triumphant, but her face was deadly white, white as salt. All this flashed through Diggory's mind in a second. Then he took to his heels and ran for the gates as hard as he could belt. The witch was after him. As soon as he was out, the gates closed behind him of their own accord. They gave him the lead, but not for long. By the time he reached the others, he was shouting out, "Quick! Get on, Polly! Get up, Fledge!" The witch had then climbed over the wall, or vaulted over it, and was close behind him again. "Stay where you are," cried Diggory, turning around to face her, "or we'll all vanish. Don't come an inch nearer." "Foolish boy," said the witch, "why do you run from me? I mean you no harm. If you do not stop and listen to me now, you will miss some knowledge that would have made you happy all your life." "Well, I don't want to hear it, thanks," said Diggory, but he honestly did. "I know what errand you've come on," continued the witch, "for it was I who was close beside you in the woods last night and heard all your counsels. You have plucked fruit in the garden yonder. You have put it in your pocket now, and you are going to carry it back, untasted, to the lion, for him to eat, for him to use. You simpleton, do you know what the fruit is? I will tell you. It is the apple of youth, the apple of life. I know, for I have tasted it, and I feel already such changes in myself that I know I shall never grow old or die. Eat it, boy, eat it, and you and I will both live forever and be king and queen of this whole world. Or of your world, if we decide to go back there." "No, thanks," said Diggory. "I don't know that I care much about living on and on after everyone I know is dead. I'd rather live an ordinary time and die and go to heaven." "But what about this mother of yours, whom you pretend to love so much?" "What's she got to do with this?" Diggory asked. "Do you not see, fool, that one bite of that apple would heal her? You have put it in your pocket. We are here by ourselves, and the lion is far away. Use your magic and go back to your own world. 1 minute later, you could be in your mother's bedside, giving her the fruit. 5 minutes later, you will see the color coming back to her face. She will tell you the pain is gone. Soon she will tell you she feels stronger. Then she will fall asleep. Think of that. Hours of sweet, natural sleep, without pain, without drugs. Next day, everyone will be saying how wonderfully she has recovered. Soon she will be quite well again. All will be well again. Your home will be happy. You will be like other boys." "Oh," Diggory gasped, as if he had been hurt, and put his hand on his head, for he now knew the most horrible choice lay before him. What has that lion ever done for you that you should be a slave?" the witch asked. "What can he do to you once you are back in your own world?
And what will your mother think if she knew that you could have taken her pain away and given back her life and saved your father's heart from being broken, and that you wouldn't, that you'd rather run messages for a wild animal in a strange world that is no business of yours? I don't think he is a wild animal, said Digger in a dried-up sort of voice. He is... I don't know. Then he is something worse, said the witch. Look at what he has done to you already. Look how heartless he has made you. That is what he does to everyone who listens to him, cruel, pitiless boy. You would let your own mother die rather than... Oh, shut up, said the miserable Diggory, still in the same voice. Do you think I don't see? But I promised. Ah, but you don't know what you were promising, and no one here can prevent you. Mother herself, said Diggory, getting the words out with difficulty, wouldn't like it. Awfully strict about keeping promises and not stealing and all that sort of thing. She'd tell me not to do it, quick as anything, if she were here. But she need never know, said the witch, speaking more sweetly than you would have thought anyone with so fierce a face could speak. You wouldn't tell her how you'd got the apple. Your father never need know. No one in your world need know anything about this whole story. You needn't take the little girl back with you, you know. That was where the witch made her fatal mistake. Of course Diggory knew that Polly could get away by her own ring as easily as he could get away by his. But apparently the witch didn't know this. And the meanness of the suggestion that he should leave Polly behind suddenly made all the other things the witch had been saying to him sound false and hollow. And even in the midst of all his misery, his head suddenly cleared. He said, in a different and much louder voice, "Look here, where do you come into all of this? Why are you so preciously fond of my mother, all of a sudden? What's it got to do with you? What's your game?" "Good for you, Diggs," whispered Polly in his ear. "Quick, get away now." She hadn't dared to say anything all through the argument because, you see, it wasn't her mother who was dying. "Up then," said Diggory, heaving her up onto Fledger's back and then scrambling up as quickly as he could. The horse then spread its wings. "Go then, fools," cried the witch. "Think of me, boy, when you lie old and weak and dying, and remember how you threw away the chance of endless youth. It won't be offered to you again." They were already so high that they could only just hear her. Nor did the witch waste any time gazing up at them. They saw her set off northward, down the slope of the hill. They had started early that morning, and what happened in the garden had not taken very long, so that Fledge and Polly both said they would easily get back to Narnia before nightfall. Diggory never spoke on the way back, and the others were shy of speaking to him. He was very sad, and he wasn't even sure all the time that he had done the right thing, but whatever he remembered, the shining tears in Aslan's eyes, he became sure. All day, Fledge flew steadily with untiring wings, eastward with the river to guide him, through the mountains and over the wild wooded hills, and then over the great waterfall and down toward the woods of Narnia were darkened by the shadows of the mighty cliff, till at last, when the sky was growing red with sunset behind them, he saw a place where many creatures were gathered together by the riverside, and soon he could see Aslan himself in the midst of them. Fledge glided down, spread out his four legs, closed his wings, and landed cantering. Then he pulled up. The children dismounted, and Diggory saw all the animals, dwarves, satyrs, nymphs, and other things drawing back to the left and to the right to make way for him. He walked up to Aslan, handed him the apple, and said, "I brought you the apple you wanted, sir."